Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
He is the ideal person to have on this week as we're talking all things Dune Part 2, and he's been our sort of long-time Dune correspondent. And this week, we'll also be hearing from Dune Part 2 director, Denis Villeneuve, and the stars of Netflix's Spaceman, Adam Sandler and Paul Dano. So a very starry episode this week, if you'll excuse the pun. And we'll also be reviewing those films and rom-zomcom Lisa Frankenstein. But before we get into all that, what have you been up to this week, Jordan, besides watching Dune multiple times?
Yeah, I'm now in the very, I guess, privileged position of having seen Dune three times, and I'm very much planning a fourth viewing, but we'll get into Dune later, of course, not to turn this into the Dune cast. The honest answer to that question is that I've been watching and re-watching 2014 Disney classic, Planes, Fire and Rescue, because I have a very young daughter and it is currently her favorite film. That's been on hard rotation in our house. After, you know, after bedtime, I have been watching Avatar The Last Airbender on Netflix, the live action adaptation of the classic Nickelodeon animation. And I'm sort of in two minds about it because I really do love the animated series. It's one of my all-time favorites. The live action version is just a bit too similar and pastiche and actually a bit too like somber and glum because it's all about like war and like the effects of war on a society and stuff, whereas the animated show had all that but was also like really just fun and funny and entertaining. So I'm not totally sold on that just yet. I've also been watching a tiny bit of Shogun on Disney Plus, only one episode in, so I can't speak on it too much, but I'm enjoying what I'm seeing so far. Very sort of Game of Thrones-y, set in feudal Japan, based on a classic novel, bit of a doorstopper, over 1,000 pages, I believe that book is, so they've got plenty of source material to draw from for this. But yeah, it's just shaping up to be something special, I think.
Yeah, I actually haven't watched that much again. Inspired by watching with children, I actually revisited a childhood favourite of mine, which was The Flintstones, the live-action adaptation of that, starring Goodman and Rick Moranis. And it was that...
Carl McLaughlin as well.
It's Carl McLaughlin, yeah. Like, and it was one of those really strange experiences where I was kind of obsessed with this film as a youngster, and I hadn't seen it since, obviously. I've kind of never revisited it in my kind of even, you know, even early adult life. I just haven't seen it since I was a kid. And then when you kind of watch something and you realize you just remember all the words and just everything's just coming back to you. You could kind of finish every line as people are saying it. And so I found it a sort of pleasant experience. I was pleased to say it kind of played well to the youth of today. And I was going to say, and while I wouldn't argue that it's like a great film per se, I thought, one, some of the visual effects held up nicely, considering how old it is. And I also just thought there was something almost fascinating about it in the way that kind of the main sort of joy and excitement about it is that you just enter this weird, silly world and it just feels like it's kind of fun. It feels very physical, a lot of it. You know, there's some digital effects, obviously, but just feels very physical in terms of the costumes and a lot of the stuff they've built. And there's some puppets in there as well. And then the kind of the drama of it is this weird kind of like family drama and friends falling out and a bit of sort of work drama in there as well, in a way. And so it was kind of interesting seeing a family film like that just doesn't really have like a big adventure angle, and like there's no sort of, you know, big chases in it or sort of typical big action scenes. So I kind of just appreciated the weirdness of it in that sense.
Have you got sequel Viva Rock Vegas lined up for the next weekend?
Well, I haven't, but I might be forced into watching that. But I never saw that at the time. I know it kind of starred Mark Addy, didn't it? Can't remember who else was in it, but yeah. I think I'd sort of aged out of it by the time that actually came out and mostly saw terrible reviews. So I never caught that. But I mean, maybe I'll sort of revisit that as a sort of curio as well. But yeah, that's
a
that's
weekend well spent.
Yeah. On to new releases now anyway. And so it's time to head back to Arrakis.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear.
So, this is Dune Part 2, the eagerly awaited sequel to sci-fi epic Dune, which will complete the job of adapting Frank Herbert's famous novel. The first film came out in 2021 and was Total Film's Film of the Year that year. So a lot is riding on this follow-up. But before we review the film, let's hear what director Denis Villeneuve had to say when you caught up with him, Jordan, the day after the film's world premiere in London.
Deal with this prophet.
Send assassins.
Fade Rotha. He's psychotic.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
Everyone will be familiar, I hope, with Dune Part 1 by this stage. Dune Part 2 is a continuation in the truest sense of the word, in the sense that I almost don't think of this film as a sequel. I think of it as the second half of the same film, in a way, separated by a 2 and a bit year intermission. Obviously, you have experience with sequels. You made Blade Runner 2049 previously. Did you approach this differently in terms of crafting a follow-up in that sense?
But the thing is that it's true that it's not a sequel. It's like, as you rightly said, it's the second half of a big story. But I wanted to make sure that if someone would not have seen Part 1, will absolutely be comfortable and understand everything watching Part 2, because we made sure at the beginning that there's a kind of recap, this most simple recap, telling us the basic ideas that you need to know in order to understand the story. So the movie is in some way autonomous. Now, saying this about the way we will make it, I knew that it will be a different beast to attack the making of Part 2. First, because the story is very different. Part 1, we are following a boy that is discovering a planet. It's a more contemplative, more meditative movie. And it's also a boy that is a victim of the events. He's have no control. He's just trying to survive through the movie. In Part 2, this boy becomes a man. He falls in love. He becomes a war fighter. He takes things into action and becomes a leader. And it's like so the movie becomes much more active, as a stronger momentum. So it's a really different beast cinematically. Part 1 was a kind of homeworks that I needed to do to explain the world. Part 2 is the fun. Like I said, just pure cinematic fun making this movie.
100%, yeah. In the past, you've described this film as more muscular and much more of an action film, something which I can 100% vouch for, having now seen the film. How did you approach the crafting of action sequences with such specific large-scale demands, particularly given your particular commitment to realizing as much of this world sort of in camera and for real as possible, when, you know, there aren't real sandworms out there for you to shoot, but that very much feels grounded and real as everything else.
We followed the same rules in Part 1, where we tried to shoot as much as possible on camera, physically, with the real stunts, and always use real desert, real environments. We spent months in the desert, and always shooting with natural light. So it's like there's like the combination of all these elements at one point brings a level of realism that we are always trying to match ourselves to reality as close as possible. So all the VFX then that come after, we try to make sure that it looks so familiar, so real, so close to nature, that you're somewhere inside you, you feel it's real. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of close to nature or not close to nature, there is a sequence in this film set on the Harkonnen homeworld of Gedi Prime, in which a kind of gladiatorial combat arena takes place, featuring one of the most important new characters in this film, Fade Rotha Harkonnen, played by Austin Butler. It appears to be black and white, but you've done something very interesting with this sequence, in that you and your cinematographer, Greg Fraser, developed a way to shoot this film using infrared lenses, and it creates a very eerie kind of otherworldly effect, something I've never really quite seen on screen this way before. How did you achieve this, and why did you want to shoot it this way?
The thing is that the idea of the black and white came from as I was writing the screenplay. I always, one thing I love about the book is how Frank Herbert studies the way humans are shaped by the environment. We are just a reaction to what surrounds us and the way we see the world, our politics, our religion, our technology is a reaction from our environment. If you want to know about the Fremen, you look at the desert. The desert will give you all the information you need to know about those people. And I did feel that as much there was a lot of description of the desert in the book and the Fremen culture, we were lacking information about the Gedi Prime, the home world of the Arcanans. The Gedi Prime is an artificial world, where the planet has all the natural environment of the planet has been subjugated to the power of the humans, and that totally created a plastic planet. One of the last remaining things that will come from nature will be light. What if in another world, sunlight was not revealing color, but killing it?
Mm-hmm.
And that will give us some information about their psyche, how they perceive the world, how they see things like, which is such a kind of brutality and that kind of fascist approach to politics. And will allow me also to create imagery that will be linked with fascism. That's the idea where the idea came from. Then, having sharing this idea with Greg Fraser, he brought the idea of IR, which really excited me. For that, we had to transform the cameras. It's not that something was done in post-production. We shot this way. I love to commit on camera. It creates something very eerie with the skin, where you see slightly through the skin, you see the veins of the characters. The eyes are very eerie too. It creates everything becomes like ghost-like. I loved how it creates, just with that device, you suddenly on somewhere else in another world, another planet.
In terms of the cast you've got, you're already working with a very deep bench of extremely talented young stars and these legends that you're bringing back to the screen. Last night, it was revealed that you've also smuggled sort of another amazing young talent into this film, unbeknownst to sort of anyone around the world until very, very recently. How were you able to keep Anya Taylor-Joy's presence in this film a secret for so long?
This is officially the first time that I'm allowed to talk about
her.
Oh,
wow.
The game I played with Anya was like to try to keep the secret. It's very difficult to keep a secret in Hollywood. And specifically with someone of an actress of that stardom. It was shot in total secrecy, and the crew signed with their blood contract. And we kept it in the post-production as a secret as possible. Her face were blurred and all the test screening for many months. It was just a game that I was playing with with the system. I love the idea that suddenly, out of nowhere, in the deep secrecy, the most intimate moment of the film, something is revealed to you as a projection to the future. She's an actress that I absolutely adore, and I can't wait to work more with her. Yeah.
I spoke to many of your cast members for our recent cover feature in the magazine, and I wanted to follow up with you about something that Javier Bardem told me. He said that he and Josh Brolin came to you and said, look, we worked together on No Country for Old Men. We didn't have a scene in that film. We really want a scene in this film. And no spoilers, but you have obliged them. Is that how you remember that experience?
No, it's like their character were meant to meet. I don't recall this. I have a bad memory, but and I'm very pleased to condemn their but maybe we are close friends and we say a lot of silly things together, so they might have seen that to me, but I didn't felt any pressure. The pressure I had, and that's true, is when Javier Bardem came on board doing part one, he said, I'm gonna do it. I agree. The only condition is you have to promise me that my character will ride a sandworm. And I said, okay, that's fair.
You've been asked and spoken many times in the past about the possibility of adapting Dune Messiah, which of course is Frank Herbert's follow-up book to Dune, about this being the potential final installment in what would be your sort of Dune saga. What is it that excites you about the idea of adapting that book and as a sort of concluding installment for your version of Dune?
But as I was writing part one, it came into my mind that it will make absolute sense to bring to the screen also the second book, Dune Messiah. That is a tiny book. It's also a book I absolutely adored. And when I read it, as Frank Herbert did with the book, I could do the same thing and see the impact of the decisions of Paul Atreides in part one and part two, and the impact on these decisions. It will complete Paul Atreides' arc beautifully.
We just heard from Denis, so now it's time for us to share our thoughts on Dune Part 2. So, Jordan, as the Dune head of the team, do you want to dive in on this one?
Needless to say, this is a follow-up to Dune Part 1. Very much a follow-up in the sense that we do just hit the ground running moments after the conclusion of that film. You may remember that Timothée Chalamet's Paul and Rebecca Ferguson's Lady Jessica head off into the deep desert with the Fremen, led by Stilgar, Javier Bardem's character, and the literal girl of Paul's dreams, Chani, played by Zendaya. So we start with them joining the Fremen tribe, and it's very much a sort of an introduction to the Fremen culture. Paul is becoming a Fremen himself. All this is part of a grand prophecy that the Fremen have of the Lisan al-Ghaib, who is a voice from the Outer Worlds, who they believe may or may not be Paul. While at the same time, Paul, of course, is seeking revenge for the massacre of his own house, House Atreides, at the hands of the Harkonnen, led by Baron Harkonnen, played by Stellan Skarsgård, of course. And there are some key new characters introduced in Part 2, including Austin Butler's Fade Rotha, who is the nephew of Baron Harkonnen, a psychotic assassin. And you also have the Emperor, Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, played by the great Christopher Walken, and his daughter, Princess Irulan, played by Florence Pugh. And it's about the political machinations of who will eventually get to control Dune and the future of this universe.
So obviously, yeah, it's a lot riding on this one. Had a lot of setup in the first film, kind of this is the action side of it in a lot of ways, I suppose. You know, this is the This Time It's War sequel. So, I mean, obviously you came to it with massive expectations, and you'd obviously, previous to this recent interview with Denis, you'd obviously spoken to him and all the cast for our cover feature. So obviously massive expectations for you. And did it live up to what you were hoping for?
Oh yeah, it lived up to it and then some. I'm a huge fan of Dune Part 1. And for me, this is at least on a par with Part 1, if not even slightly better in my eyes. It is obviously the concluding adaptation of the second half of Frank Herbert's book. In some ways, a much more challenging and daunting task for Denis and the rest of his team. Part 1 is obviously a huge world-building exercise and a big expositional exercise setting up the story. This is where basically all the payoff is. This is where you get the worm riding. This is where you get the huge battles. This is where you get the culmination of all the character arcs. There's a great deal of stuff in here which you didn't see in Part 1. It's not like you're just seeing more of the same thing. I felt like I was getting a lot different. I love Denis' approach to both parts of these films. I think the decision to take a more tactile approach, to shoot as much of this film in camera as possible, to actually go into the deserts of, you know, Wadi Rum in Jordan and Abu Dhabi, to actually shoot in golden hour and catch the sunlight bouncing off the sand dunes. Like, I think all that stuff really pays off here, because even when you have clear digital elements in the frame, giant sandworms racing across the screen, everything just feels real. Everything just feels so transportive and immersive. And as I sort of outlined at the beginning of that sort of brief plot synopsis, for the best part of an hour at the start of this film, you're just with Paul as he's learning the Fremen ways, essentially becoming part of Fremen culture. And I was so absorbed in that, to the point that when we eventually cut to like other characters in other places, I was just taken out of the film for a moment when I realized, oh yeah, there are all these other people and all these other things that have to happen in this film as well. Just being part of the Fremen world just totally transported me. And then on top of that, you get absolutely incredible stuff on Gedi Prime, which is the Harkonnen homeworld, which, as you'll have heard in that interview with Denis, appears to have been shot in black and white, but was actually shot using infrared lenses, which gives us this almost like glowy, eerie, otherworldly effect where people's skin looks almost translucent. And their eyes turn black and you see like fireworks go off and they almost look like kind of blotches of ink rather than explosions of light. And Denis's like just such an artistic filmmaker and such an experimental filmmaker, especially for someone operating at this scale and in this space. And he's just doing things that I don't think other filmmakers would ever conceive doing. Certainly in terms of the visuals, he's very much about the experience of the whole thing. And in that sense, I just found it totally absorbing. And then, as you say, a much more muscular, much more action-packed film. Pretty early on, we get some pretty terrific set pieces. And I'd say there's like probably three or four of like my favorite sort of action sequences, certainly in terms of like blockbuster sci-fi in like years in this film. And the way he directs action is just feels really, again, just feels really grounded and real and very eerie and otherworldly. And then there really is stuff in this that I don't think I've ever seen on screen before, even though we have had another filmed adaptation of Dune. Like he somehow manages to do things with the action that hasn't been put on screen before. I was just totally thrilled. I've seen it in both, so the 2.39 presentation, which will be how most people see it, and I've seen it in IMAX as well. And it's just one of those films where it's become a cliche, but it's just like totally awe-inspiring on like a huge IMAX screen. Like it really just envelops your whole peripherals and you really just feel like you're being transported to Arrakis. I just can't get enough of it. Also, just to say, as an adaptation of that book, like necessarily there are things that are cut out. Like I'm a fan of that book, a huge fan of that book. But I think like all the changes that he's made in terms of adapting the story are incredibly smart and are for the most part only to the benefit of the film. Sure, there are a few things I'm a bit disappointed to see on the cutting room floor that haven't made the transition to the film. But what we do get for me is, you know, basically the definitive version of that story, like even in some ways above the book, I would say. Like when I think Dune, I will think of these films at this point.
Wow. It's interesting because like I sort of need to caveat my thoughts with the fact that obviously I've only seen this once in comparison to your three viewings. And I'm very keen to see it again because a lot of people I trust and really value obviously rate it so highly, including obviously Kevin Harley as well, who wrote our review. He kind of wrote an amazing review, kind of read online as well if you want to check that out. And there was so much I really, really did like about this. I loved the first Dune. But I kind of come to this as very much not a Dune head. Like I've never read the book. I've taken a couple of runs at it and never been able to kind of get into it. And I saw the Lynch film like years ago, but don't really remember it enough to kind of serve as like, you know, spoiling what was going to happen in this film for me, to be honest. So I was coming to it very fresh. And it is very much a film I want to revisit more than once, partly because like you say, it's such an essential big screen experience really. And it's the kind of film, like I get this with Nolan films as well. Where you feel like you just want to make the most of it while it is in cinemas. And it's probably the kind of film that I'm sure will get, you know, re-released in IMAX over the years because just how, you know, how well it plays there. But, you know, you kind of want to make the most of it while it is out. But I kind of like really, really liked it with just a few more qualms than I've seen sort of, you know, some people have. And on first viewing, I didn't enjoy it quite as much as the first film. But again, the qualms were sort of small in comparison to how much I did enjoy. For example, obviously you mentioned the sandworm riding, and that was a scene in the kind of cinema where I saw it in. I haven't kind of experienced anything like that for a long time, where the felt feeling so immersed in it, and then particularly with the kind of sound of it and it feeling so rumbly. I genuinely like could feel it like reverberating through my body. I was sitting fairly close to the front. And I genuinely felt like I was like rumbling in my chair, and it was this weird kind of like immersive experience. And obviously it's such a huge scale thing to try and capture, but I really thought he nailed it completely, you know, like lots of great performances in it, particularly of the newcomers. I did particularly like Austin Butler, I must say. Thought he was just kind of great in that sort of psychotic, charismatic kind of role. Obviously he has that, you know, that kind of fascinating sort of black and white world, you know, we see him on as well. And I loved even what he did with his voice, that he has like a little sort of inflection of Stellan Skarsgård's accent, you know, because of his kind of relation to the Baron. So yeah, so there was just loads I liked. And again, as you said, visually, I feel like I haven't seen that kind of that sort of mix of visual effects and practical effects and settings just looking that good for. I mean, it's up there with the kind of greatest achievements, really, I think, in terms of those kind of visual effects. And especially as it's just slightly unlike other sci-fi you've seen, maybe because of that tactility of the desert sort of settings and shooting there for real. But even just in the way that kind of the characters move sometimes, and there's like a scene really early on where these sort of Harkonnen soldiers rocket pack up to this like cliff effectively, but they just move in such a strange, like I say unnatural way, but unnatural in the sense that it's just not like you see in typically how people would blast off in a sci-fi. And that's like really early on. And then I just found something so arresting about that, like that you just feel like you're in this strange world, and you just feel this world has its rules, even though it's so unusual. It feels so sort of real at the same time. Yeah, I kind of really like that. And there was just lots I liked about it. And again, perhaps one of my bigger qualms, and I do feel like I'm saying it again, one of the main reasons why I want to see it again, really, is that I often have a thing with films, especially when I'm highly anticipating them and there's a lot riding on them, but where I almost appreciate it more on the second viewing once I've kind of consumed it all once and then get the chance to have a kind of another run at it with kind of more managed expectations, I suppose, in what to expect. But some ways the story didn't go quite as I was kind of expecting. And I'd obviously heard a lot about, I mean, there has been a lot of talk about Dune Messiah, Denny doing that as a sort of, you know, a third installment to really kind of complete this story he's telling. But I kind of came to this expecting it to feel more finished, I suppose. And again, I feel like maybe I would just appreciate it more on a second viewing, but I was surprised at how much you kind of come away, or that I came away thinking, all right, yeah, we really do need this third film to kind of complete this story that I've kind of invested in up to this point. Yeah, I just was kind of like, I was like, kind of, oh, it ended there. And we've both made this comparison before, I know, but I make the hugely positive comparison to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, just in terms of, yeah, like adapting sort of, you know, an epic work like that in such a kind of definitive way. And also particularly for me, in just that transportive nature of the world building, and just really feeling like you're going to this different fantasy or sci-fi realm, and just truly feeling that kind of transportive effect that kind of, you know, cinema and blockbusters can do at its very kind of best. And that's something I obviously just loved about films and going to the cinema growing up, but you really get that full immersion and transportation these days, I find, in films of this kind of scale, and films that kind of take it this seriously compared to, like, you know, the quippiness of a lot of modern blockbusters, or the kind of fun disposability of them. This kind of feels like a work with serious kind of heft, and, you know, just every element of it seems like care's gone into it. I remember this from Jordan's feature as well, from Denis saying sort of words to this effect, I think. But I really thought Hans Zimmer, obviously, he kind of always delivers, you know, people love him. And I remember Denis saying about just how much music he kind of delivered, and just kind of kept bringing this. But I even thought here, like, the score for the first film was, you know, immediately kind of outstanding, and people really loved it, and became kind of iconic with some of that kind of like chanting, singing, and every, you know, immediately something you just associate
with bagpipes.
But then I thought this even perhaps just delivered even beyond that. You know, I was kind of completely knocked out by the score, and obviously that just adds to the whole sort of feel of the world. I wondered as well, again, how much the minor qualms I had in terms of that cameo, for example, that was mentioned in the interview just then. To me, I didn't fully kind of appreciate that, I suppose, because it didn't, as someone who's not familiar with the book and the story, I didn't fully kind of appreciate that character. And again, I wonder if going into it with these managed expectations, I would just feel a bit differently the second time, maybe. But despite kind of saying these qualms, these are kind of minor qualms in what is like a major work. And there's just some really sort of freaky image in it as well, I think, for a blockbuster. Yeah. And I was kind of waiting to see what the BBFC certificate was going to be, because it has been sort of classified as a 12A for moderate violence, bloody images and threat. But to me, I know we say this every time kind of a big 12A comes out, but it does feel like it's pushing the limits, and some of the things that just Fade Rauther's character gets up to, even though a lot of it's implied, you know, it's not full on gore, but I think there's a lot that was, I thought, yeah, kind of pushing the boundary if you're kind of considering taking someone, you know, much younger than 12 to see this. And just some sort of freak imagery, like some kind of fetal imagery, I suppose I'll say, that just was so striking on the cinema. And again, obviously Denis, really, like, I mean, he's kind of proved himself so much over the last few years. He's just kind of on his last, he's kind of, you know, his run of films he's been on, he's just kind of delivered and delivered and delivered.
For me, he's basically the preeminent epic science fiction director operating right now. Like, he's doing things that just no one else is doing, really.
He's really kind of put himself into that league now, hasn't he? Just the top directors working today, I think. And some of those visuals were just so striking. And again, feel really distinct. And like I say, kind of talking about some of the disturbing elements, again, just someone who has that ability and that kind of clout to be able to push those through on what is obviously like a massive blockbuster and, you know, tracking mm-hmm. to open massively. It's obviously like a huge sort of Warner Brothers property. That is just so kind of admirable to see someone operating on that level on this kind of scale of film. And clearly just, mm-hmm. I mean, no impression at all of him being curtailed in any way. Like he kind of feels like, obviously he's done a lot with Nolan, for example, with them kind of re-releasing Tenet, sort of a similar Tenet, time and,
yeah.
and trailing a bit of Dune too with that. But he feels like he's kind of nipping at Nolan's heels almost in kind of entering those kind of top tiers of directors working today and kind of mm-hmm. working with that uncontained kind of vision, you know, that's just fully out there and giving the impression mm-hmm. they're just fully in kind of charge of their craft and just firing on all cylinders, basically.
Mm. I also think he works tremendously well with actors. Like it's a slightly underrated element of his abilities, because obviously Dune has this remarkable cast of like basically the hottest young actors in Hollywood now, plus a phalanx of total like screen legends from the last couple of decades. And he just gets great performances out of everyone. Mm. Like, I know, like Timothée Chalamet is, you know, one of the most sort of bankable young stars at the moment. I've never been quite as up on him as other people seem to be, owing to the fact that I wasn't like the biggest fan of Call Me By Your Name, certainly not as big as other people seem to be. But this was the first film where I was really sort of convinced by him as like a screen presence. Like there are moments here where he has like serious like gravitas and heft on screen. I was really like surprisingly blown away by him in this film. And then Javier Bardem is just like an absolute hoot as Stilgar. The whole like element
really
of his character,
well. Yeah, that was a really pleasant surprise for me.
I mean, it comes into the like the whole sense of humor element as well, in terms of like it's not a quippy film, but there is like there's almost like a streak of like there's a satire of like religious fanaticism running through the whole thing, and all that comes from Javier Bardem, who delivers this almost like sort of cheeky performance, which is actually very different from the character in the books, and I really like the change. And then he very much increases the presence of the female characters in the film as well, Chani and Lady Jessica primarily, and particularly Chani, who in the books is just like Paul's devout follower, essentially, and lover, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in the film, she's very much like anti-Paul in some ways, well, certainly anti the prophecy. And that just becomes a really strong, like, thematic theme, or just a theme that runs throughout the film, which is goes right through to the end and can only like go through to the third film now. So he's clearly like thought about the arc of the whole series as well. Yeah, just great character work. I mean, Denis obviously made this slightly odd claim recently that he doesn't like dialogue in films, but it's such a great screenplay. Mm-hmm. Like there are really memorable lines of dialogue in this, and it's clearly very thoughtfully structured and all smartly paced. Even though it's a 2.75-hour film, I wasn't bored for a second. I wasn't bored for a second after the third viewing, you know. So he's clearly doing something right in terms of writing a screenplay. So yeah, I mean, for me, it's just like if every blockbuster was like this, we'd be eating well, you know. I wouldn't be able to ask for anything more from cinema, essentially.
I mean, the last film, as I mentioned, was our number one film of the year in 2021. And I think this has kind of come out of the gate early, hasn't it, this year? But it's going to be fairly hard to top this, I think, isn't it? I think it kind of goes into pole position, what's going to be kind of right up there in our films of the year list, I think.
Certainly a strong early contender.
Yeah, really is a top tier sort of blockbuster in that sense. So that is, of course, Dune Part 2, which is in cinemas from Friday. And you do really want to see it on the biggest screen with the biggest sound system you can. And next up, it's a completely different kind of science fiction.
He's not doing well. He misses his wife. And he shouldn't have left.
Six months in isolation. You start thinking too much.
I'm getting an appearance.
I did not intend to frighten you, skinny human. Do not be afraid.
I'm losing my mind.
This is Spaceman, which stars Adam Sandler as a Czech astronaut called Jakub, and he's traveling to the far reaches of the solar system to collect some ancient cosmic matter. And he's also having to face up to sort of difficult things in his personal life and the fact that his relationship with his wife, Lenka, played by Kerry Mulligan, is on the rocks. And as the loneliness of Jakub's mission begins to set in, he's visited by a mysterious spider-like creature who's voiced by Paul Dano. Now, before me and Jordan discuss this film, our deputy online editor, Faye Watson, recently sat down with Adam Sandler and Paul Dano, and here's what they had to say.
Your loneliness intrigued me.
Why are you here?
I might be of help. I wish to assist you in your emotional distress.
I don't need your help.
But you do.
You go where I go, and I go where you go, right, Spaceman?
These are your thoughts. I am simply finding them with you. Everything that begins must end.
I'm not allowing that.
You go where I go, and I go where you go.
I just want to come home.
Adam, if I could start with you. When describing this film, director Johan Renck said that he wanted to make a character with zero Adam Sandler in it. What did you think about that approach?
Offended. I was wondering what the hell his problem was. But no, I understood it would be nice to just be this person you haven't seen before and try to fall away from stuff you've seen me do in other movies. And I was 100% in. I said, if you see me repeat myself, make sure you tap me on the shoulder. And he'd tap me on the shoulder maybe 50 times a day.
And Paul, I'd say your character is quite unexpected too. Obviously, Hanush is a spider-like alien. What did you think when the idea was pitched first to you?
I loved the idea, and then I loved the execution of it too. But just, Adam Sandler alone on a spaceship talking to a giant spider, already, sort of want to see it or want to read it, right? I sort of loved, that he was like this death doula, spirit guide, Zen-like sort of guy who's lived through all this time and all these galaxies. And I think I liked that the film was about, sort of the mystery in ourselves. And I feel very much like science fiction kind of allows for that thing of like, okay, you're out here in space, but really like you're alone on the inside. I felt like it was a pretty cool exploration of that.
Adam, Jakub at one point is called the loneliest man in the world. And yes. I can imagine filming this kind of alone quite a lot of the time was an unusual experience as well. How did you find that aspect of the process?
It was made sense to the movie to try to keep myself alone throughout the shoot. Yeah, it's sad. It's tough. It's like we were discussing. It's when you're in that capsule, you're up. You're so far away from anybody else. There's no noise to block what you're thinking. It's tough to actually hear what's going on in your head sometimes, and what's making you, and where you can get relief from stuff that's painful.
And I was also reading that you two were able to have a little bit of rehearsal time together, which is quite unusual, I guess.
We did. We got to do it on the Zoom.
This was also the beginning. It was pretty early in the pandemic, right?
Yes.
So we were just zooming and working through the script, and it was actually a nice thing to have there.
Yeah. Every time we got together, it got better and better and more connected, and realized the way we were going to play the characters more and more. And then Paul came by the set a few times while we were shooting, while I was hanging in the air. And we had a great time getting to know each other.
And Paul, I know that you have in the past kind of delved quite deeply into your characters' backstories. I know you did it with the Riddler and Batman. Did you kind of approach this role in the same way at all?
I guess so. I mean, first of all, I took everything that's in there at complete face value, meaning I remember Johan asking me when we first, met or read the script or talked or whatever, do you think Hanush is real? And I was like, well, of course, there's no way to play somebody who's not real, one. Two, I actually really liked what was there in terms of his little backstory, which is his civilization has been lost to these Garampids, and that he's been traveling for thousands of years, and that he himself is headed back towards the beginning. I don't know that I'd want to go back to the beginning alone. And I think that he discovers some human feeling called love through Jakob. So, you know, each character is a little different, each piece is a little different, and I think you have to follow what that thing is asking you for, what it's leading you towards. So, but yeah, generally you want to build a little life.
Yeah, and Adam, I know that this is probably quite an emotionally taxing role, but it seemed quite physically taxing as well, kind of conveying zero gravity with those rigs and wires. What was that process like, and what were some of the challenges with it?
Well, I never 100% was comfortable. I definitely was in positions that my body was not meant for. Most people probably could have done better than me, but I, from action to cut, did the best I could. With floating around and feeling like I was in no gravity and trying to act and feel the pain I needed to feel. And my goodness, it was always a tough day, but a great day.
And one of the things that surprised me the most when watching the film was how soothing and hypnotic I found it.
I agree with you. The music kind of overwhelms you, and the visuals and what it's going through the movie. It is kind of an experience, pretty damn fresh experience.
Yeah, when you kind of reach the end, you're almost in a different kind of state. I don't know how to
explain. Yes.
I mean, because obviously a lot of the process required you both to have a lot of imagination. So I was going to ask, like, what were your kind of first reactions to seeing it all come together when you watched the film?
Yeah, I think it's really always fun to see what the film looks like and sort of the colors of this film, that weird, like, almost green, you know, your suit. And it's really fun to see, I think, Adam's performance.
I like Hanush. I like seeing Hanush's performance. I like his smile. I like his legs.
He does have a sweet little smile.
Teeth.
Carrie's incredible in the film, too.
Unbelievable.
I didn't get to see anything of hers. I got to see a little of yours.
Yes,
so that was really fun.
Carrie's
to see her
in the movie. She is just ridiculous how good she is.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you mentioned Hanush and seeing him on screen. I do think this film is going to help cure a lot of people's arachnophobia. I was wondering if either of you had to overcome any kind of fear of spiders with this one.
I did. I used to have a reoccurring dream about spiders, so I've never loved them, just because I would wake up and I had this whole thing, and so I had to make a little bit of peace with that. But look, I mean, Hanush, even his designs, you know, there's
something cuddly about him.
Something cuddly.
Yeah, it's not as... by the way, I never look at a spider long enough to see if I can try to connect with this thing. I just try to find a way to get it out of the house immediately or have someone else do that for me.
Also, another thing they bond over is the hazelnut chocolate spread. Was that something that you both could relate to?
Oh, boy.
By the way, it was a extra thick spread whenever I would eat that thing. I don't know about Hanush, if they gave you the thicker stuff, but the props was giving me, it wasn't 100% Nutella. It was something else going on in there, and it led to, dare I say, slight constipation.
Slight.
my wife's sister makes homemade Nutella.
Really?
And I will ask her, I'll say, for my birthday, just
make
me some
Nutella. That's cool.
It's very good.
Yeah, good. I didn't even know about Nutella.
I wasn't a Nutella guy either.
My wife introduced me to it many years ago. She liked it a lot. I would say, like, what is that? In America, it wasn't a giant hit, but now it's become a smash over there too.
I haven't seen it in a while. I hope it's there, but I think Hanush has a mic drop final moment. You know,
it's still there. It does taste like home.
Jordan, obviously we've heard a bit from the stars there, but what did you make of this film?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I don't know what I expected going in. I was not aware of the fact that this is based on an absurdist Czech novel called Spaceman of Bohemia, which probably tells you sort of a lot about what to expect in some ways, although in other ways, I got something very unexpected. Of course, Adam Sandler stars, but this is very much not Adam Sandler in his usual comedy register. This is the Adam Sandler of Punch Drunk Love, of Uncut Gems, very much Adam Sandler in dramatic mode, essentially. He is playing a very somber, very downbeat character. It's an existential film, which I wasn't expecting, that also has a giant spider with a human mouth. Just lots of very unusual contradictions. The things that I enjoyed were the small details about being a solo astronaut in space. I thought it got really right. There's a kind of strange fixation on his broken toilet, which I kind of got a little bit obsessed with towards the end. And he has to take like these little drops to go to sleep, and every time he kind of gulps them out of the air, I was like, oh, that's a nice little detail. And then because of this sort of absurdist satirical streak it has, there is an element of like the commercialization of space travel has obviously gone on in this world. So you have Jakub kind of filming these adverts to camera and performing these ad slogans over the radio as part of his sort of deal to go into space. So it's kind of got a streak of like Behoven RoboCop satire in it as well, which is very unexpected. And then once Hannes, the giant talking spider voiced by Paul Dano, turns up, it basically turns into like a couch therapy session for the rest of the film, where they're just sort of chatting to each other about their feelings and emotions and the fact that Jakob is obviously basically estranged from his wife back down on Earth, and this complicated past that he has with his own father, who is like a communist informant. And there's just a lot of weird stuff going on in this. And I sort of expected to love it a bit more than I did. I ultimately found it just a little bit uneventful, despite the fact there's a giant spider in it, and just a little bit like dry and not as emotional as it kind of thinks it's being, I think. And ultimately, like, it's probably a bit of a harsh word, but I did find it just a bit boring. Like, I wasn't like fully engaged by it in a way that I was hoping. It's kind of beautifully shot. Johan Renck directed Chernobyl, the sensational HBO miniseries. So he's obviously a very sort of capable director in that sense. And there's a sort of touch of Malick to the way that he kind of shoots the sequences back on Earth, kind of the romanticism of the countryside and human life, and then versus the kind of almost sterile quality of the spaceship that Jakob is on, the kind of limited space and how he makes use of that. So it's certainly not a bad looking film. It's just, yeah, I just was never fully engaged or fully on board with it in a way that slightly disappointed me by the end.
But it's interesting because I actually do feel largely similar to what you said, really, to be honest, going all through that. But maybe I liked it a tiny bit more than you, but definitely had similar feelings. And again, yeah, it was this kind of strange mix. And especially as it being like a Netflix film, I think if you're the sort of person who normally searches for Adam Sandler films on Netflix, that you would definitely be kind of surprised with this. But I'd say my main difference to you is I didn't reach a point of boredom, I wouldn't say, but it's had a feeling of slightness. And I kind of came away thinking it has all these interesting elements going on, which I suppose kind of kept me interested throughout. And I do like Adam Sandler in this mode. And I always like Carey Mulligan as well. Kind of, enjoyed that aspect of it. I did like all these weird things going on about like the weird commercialization aspects. And for me, space and space exploration is a bit like boxing. By that I mean I have no interest of it in real life, but always enjoy it on film and like it as a way to kind of explore things. And so this is classic in that territory of like going into space to find yourself kind of thing. And I mean, maybe it may be an obvious comparison away, but it sort of reminded me of Solaris a bit as well, kind of just thinking of classic sci-fi and partly in the kind of, texture and retro feeling of it, but also just in that classic, like reaching this weird kind of, dimension that's having this weird effect on someone. And obviously how they're kind of thinking about their past plays out through that. And yeah, and it was odd because I was kind of engaged, but it never sort of soared to that next level for me, really. It kind of I liked it all the way through and thought there was lots interesting in it, but yeah, never quite just then broke out into then becoming what I would consider like, a great film or like, a must recommend. It was like, interesting, glad I watched it, but just didn't quite break that barrier into the like, oh yeah, that was great. And perhaps some of the kind of therapy speak aspect of it was sort of interesting, but because it's so on the nose in the way it's done, it was almost like, not really leaving much for you to sort of kind of bring to it yourself. Maybe that it was kind of really spelling out what his, issues were and how they were kind of walking through them. And it was very, very kind of like a sort of heavy-handed in terms of a metaphor, I thought. And for all that was going on and for all I was kind of interested in it, and like I say, for all that I like these actors, I yeah, perhaps didn't feel like a kind of, yeah, like an emotional wallop that I would hope to at the end of this, and that you do in the best best kind of these films. Yeah, overall, I thought it was, yeah, an interesting film, but yeah, with just a few hesitations.
Yeah, I broadly agree. Did you find the fact that obviously Adam Sandler is playing a Czech character here, as most of the actors are? Did you find the fact that famous American Adam Sandler was playing Czech was a little bit distracting? I wasn't sure if that was sort of an intentional choice just to almost double down on the absurdism of the whole scenario, or if they just thought, yeah, Adam Sandler would be good for this role, let's just go for it.
Yeah, I actually did find it a little bit distracting. And obviously Kerry Mulligan's doing the sort of same as well. And mm-hmm. I found that like there wasn't the biggest commitment to the accents, perhaps particularly from Adam Sandler, especially, that made me think like partway through, I was like, wait, did I just imagine that he was ever trying to do a Czech accent here? And has he just gone back for the American? But it kind of wavered in and out with a sort of mild one, which made me think that I guess maybe they'd have gone stronger on it if they were playing up the sort of absurd comedy, but I don't know. But yeah, I did find
I couldn't
that
quite work out what they were going for. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because they also have like Isabella Rossellini in there as well. Like probably the most Italian woman on the planet playing a Czech person. Yeah. Just all very, very odd choices all round.
But yeah. It certainly does add to the absurdity a bit. And like you mentioned, the kind of teeth of this spider character, like there's, again, if you don't like spiders, there are a few like, you know, images to be sort of fearful of in here, I would say, even though he's like you know, largely speaking, a friendly character. But a few kind of, even I'm not fussed about spiders, but a few kind of gross images, like when he first arrives. And then there is something very odd about when you can see his mouth and his teeth kind of talking, because he's otherwise feels like a pretty biologically sort of anatomically correct kind of spider. You know, fairly realistically sort of rendered, but then with just this weird kind of human mouth you can just about see kind of, you know, under his many eyes.
Yeah, but, very, very interesting character design decision. I'd love to pick Johan Renck's brain and work out what was going on there. I guess the other thing to note is that we don't know whether or not this spider is real or not, which I guess is the one sort of element of the film which is sort of left open to interpretation, which I found pretty interesting in the sense that it's either a portrait of a man who's completely losing his mind on the edge of the galaxy, or there is another form of life out there, and what does that mean for the future of our species and whatnot. But I thought it does wrestle with some really interesting ideas, and there's kind of a lot going on, but yeah, ultimately just wasn't as thrilled by it as I hoped I would be. Like for me, like the closest comparison, apart from, you know, Tarkovsky of course, Solaris, is in recent memory, at least anyways, like Ad Astra, the Brad Pitt sci-fi film, which is very much in a similar sort of vein, sort of existential space sci-fi movie. And that for me just worked a lot better, even though I know it's a slightly divisive film. Whereas this one just felt like a bit too small scale, bit too like unambitious in some ways. Yeah, and just didn't all entirely gel for me.
No, I agree. Yeah, and so that is Spaceman. That has been in select cinemas, but it is now hitting Netflix from Friday. And now just time for our final review of the week.
You hear that?
I'm sure it's the girl next door. She's very odd.
You're him? I can't believe you're here.
Do you like music?
I have the cure.
Ooh.
Oh, not that kind of cure. They can't make you better. I mean, they can, but like emotionally. No, don't cry. Your tears smell so bad. Send it back.
You need a friend.
No? I love it. It's not really my style.
When you're in doubt.
Lisa looks good.
She could probably even do pageants if she had congeniality. Your daughter is a little psycho. I'd open my glorious home to an ungrateful little.
So this is Lisa Frankenstein. Jordan, could you introduce this for us?
Yeah, so this is the directorial debut of Zelda Williams, daughter of Robin Williams, and it's written by Diablo Cody, famed screenwriter of Juno, Young Adult, and many, many more. It is a sort of return to the horror comedy genre, which Diablo Cody was obviously very burnt by in previous years with Jennifer's Body. It stars Catherine Newton as Lisa Swallow. She is a high school student whose mother was killed by an axe murderer. She has been adopted into a new family. And at the start of the film, we learn that Lisa is, she's a bit of like a gothic outcast kind of character in high school. She's the type of person who goes to the local cemetery and kind of romantically swoons in front of the tombstone of a young boy who died centuries earlier. One night she goes to a sort of house party with fellow high school students, and there's a sort of weird green storm going on overhead. At this party, Lisa imbibes some kind of narcotic and starts hallucinating. And then as a consequence of this night, there is a sort of wish that is granted where this long dead boy that she has been visiting the graveyard of sort of comes back to life essentially and makes his way to her home as an undead walking corpse. This is the creature played by Cole Sprouse. And then the film kind of goes from there in the sense that it's a sort of burgeoning romance between the two. Lisa has a sort of desire for another boy in school, but it's very clear that the creature is in love with Lisa from the start. And the creature is not whole and requires bits of body parts to become a real boy in a sense. And as the film progresses, he acquires those body parts in various gruesome and bloody ways. The tone of this is very 100% 80s, I should say. It's sort of the love child of Tim Burton and John Hughes, I would say, tonally. Visually very much inspired by Burton's 80s output, particularly things like Edward Scissorhands and, you know, the early Batman films. And then the John Hughesiness just comes from that's a sort of high school element as well. I honestly wouldn't have been surprised if this was revealed to be some like lost John Hughes script that was left in one of his bottom drawers years ago, because it does really just have that kind of weird science vibe as well. I wasn't totally sold on it, if I'm 100% honest. One of my biggest issues was that it felt like there was almost competing authorial voices in some ways. Zelda Williams does have a very sort of forceful visual style with it. There are like a lot of fantasy sequences, a lot of sort of dream sequences, which are done in varying different styles. There's some really like striking sort of almost like storybook sets and animated sequences, even all this kind of stuff. Like there's a lot of ideas that have been packed into this. But then you do have a lot of moments which are just like, just very, very dialogue heavy. And there's just not much going on except like a two shot between two people. And in those moments, I just felt like Diablo Cody's script like almost just took over too much. So I felt like there wasn't quite the right synergy between like the direction and the script writing in this case. And then, and not to get too much into spoilers, but the film very much just sort of peters out towards the end in a way that I found like very unsatisfying. It almost felt like there was just something cut from the end. Like it felt like there was a big sequence or just some kind of extra act that was taken out, and it just ended in a way where I thought, oh, are we finished now, are we okay, guess I'll shuffle out the cinema, head on my way. Yeah, so not a completely successful exercise, but I did have a reasonable amount of fun with it.
Yeah, I kind of don't really kind of massively disagree with any of that. Like, full disclosure, I did interview Diablo Cody for the magazine for a piece a little while back, sort of saw the film for that, and I really, really enjoyed speaking to her. Like, she's obviously very smart, you know, and even made me think about this film slightly different because of having seen it before I did the interview. It was interesting talking to her about it. But yeah, I kind of just agree with most of what you said, and would put it similarly to Spaceman in a way, even though they're obviously just very different films. It had that thing where it wasn't, again, wasn't quite any more than the sum of its parts in that sense. And where I kind of enjoyed it and there was a lot of interesting things going on, but again, without that thing of it kind of breaking the barrier into absolute sort of greatness for me. I always find Catherine Newton to be like a sort of fun screen presence. And I also really liked Lisa Soberano, who's kind of plays the sort of best friend. Basically, she was one of those people that, you know, when you kind of see somebody in the film and you, I think it's her first big kind of US role, but you just feel like there would be kind of probably big things in her future. And she was very funny. She kind of gets a lot of the best kind of classic Diablo Cody dialogue. She sort of is a good friend in a way, but doesn't always kind of like come across in the best way, I suppose. And has that kind of just like, I guess, sort of inherent selfishness that gets in the way of their friendship. So I sort of liked her a lot. And again, I sort of saw this because of seeing it sort of quite early for an interview. I didn't really know where it was going, but I didn't know a huge amount about it when I saw it, and didn't hugely know where it was going. And Yeah, didn't feel like it necessarily, yeah, did go in the most completely satisfying direction. Again, like to bring it back to an earlier film, but like Dune, I'd be interested to see how I'd feel on a second viewing, coming in with more expectations of what kind of film it was. And again, I'm always a fan of when there is, something which has like a bold voice and is a bit different and is trying something just a bit weird. So I kind of appreciated that. But yeah, I'd similarly be lying if I said I found the film like, entirely sort of satisfying. It was kind of fun, but very throwaway for me. Again, similar to Spaceman, it didn't really kind of stick in my mind too long afterwards, really.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. There are some really fun supporting turns, as you say. I really enjoyed Carla Gugino as the kind of overbearing mother-in-law, like just very heightened and just over the top, but like sort of perfect in that role. And there are some like really zinging lines that you get from Diablo Cody's scripts. One that sticks in the mind is like the creature has like these really awfully stinky tears, and at one point Lisa describes the tears as smelling like a hot toilet at a carnival. And I just thought, yeah, that's just like such a great line. Like, you really just can't fault Diablo Cody's ability to knock those out like every so often. So they really keep the energy up, but it just kind of went in like quite a predictable direction, like eventually. And you can just sort of see where it's going, and doesn't really take any interesting turns. Like, even the quote unquote twists of it are like just very predictable, especially if you know like 80s high school movies. Like, it's just very obvious sort of where it's all going. Like, probably the biggest surprise is sort of the violent turns, I guess. Those do sort of come out of nowhere a little bit, and some of them are like quite gruesome and shocking, but nothing in a sense that like you would be like turning your eyes away from the screen or anything. Like, it's all sort of played for laughs, but they sort of don't shy away from that stuff. And yeah, Catherine Newton, she's just a star, isn't she? Like, sort of deserves more leading roles. I really loved her in Freaky, which was another horror comedy, which I sort of think played to her strengths a little bit more as someone who's good at playing a serial killer in a teenage girl's body. I would love to recommend it, but I sort of can't. If you really feel like you want to spend a Friday night watching this instead of Dune Part Two, then be my guest. But if I was you, I would sort of wait till it turns up on streaming.
So that was Lisa Frankenstein, and that's also in cinemas from Friday. And another new release we haven't really got time to review this week is Red Island, which is the new one from 120 BPM director Robin Campillo. It's set in a French military camp in Madagascar in the 70s, and it gets a 4-star review in Total Film. And our reviewer says it imaginatively blends the personal and the political. So that's in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema from Friday, if you again fancied something a bit different. So, I mean, I barely need to ask this, seeing as Jordan hasn't seen Lisa Frankenstein or Spaceman 3 times each. But what is your film of the week, Jordan?
Dune Part Two. Yeah, let's go again.
I'm definitely, as I discussed, I'm definitely seeing it again. And even with my kind of slight qualms I explained, it's still, I mean, just hands down film of the week for me. And like I say, I can we'll be up there contender for films of the year, I'm sure. Any blockbusters coming out later this year have had like the gauntlet well and truly thrown down now, I think. So yeah, so that's easily our film of the week, Dune Part Two. And we're approaching the end of this podcast now, but we have to also say that out on Friday this week is the very exciting new issue of Total Film, and on the cover is Roadhouse, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. I spoke to those guys and more of that cast for that feature, and you can see some exclusives from that on our website now over at gamesradar.com/totalfilm, and you can read the full thing when it's out on Friday. And this is a particularly exciting issue for me and Jordan, not just because it's jam-packed with great stuff, but because it's my first issue as editor and Jordan's first as deputy editor. And inside, we've also got features on Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire, Fallout TV show, Three Body Problem, Love Lies Bleeding, Abigail, and loads more. So please do check it out on Friday. And if you are a subscriber to Total Film, or if you subscribe with our new kind of offering, you can get access to a complete digital archive, which goes back more than 10 years' worth of issues. If you subscribe now, you'll be able to access the Roadhouse issue digitally as soon as it's on sale on Friday. And also, if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others find us. And please remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or just email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. And before we go, just time for one quick question, which is a really obvious one, but what's your favorite part two in cinema?
I assume I'm not allowed to say June. Too soon to say June.
Too soon.
I mean, the obvious answer is The Godfather Part Two, of course. Probably, oh, well, I shouldn't say this because Aliens is my favorite film, but one of the greatest sequels ever made. Just an absolute masterpiece, an absolute classic. Just does what so like few sequels ever do, in that it just like properly builds on the first one, goes forwards and backwards. Like I just love everything about it. Probably prefer it to The Godfather. Not a hugely controversial statement, but I know The Godfather does have its advocates as well. And then
I love part two, but I am a The Godfather person myself.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I mean, they're both like 5-star masterpieces, like up there with the greatest films of all time. So sort of degrees of brilliance, really, isn't it? It's not night and day. Yeah, what about you, Matt? What's your favourite part two?
Yeah, it's tough. But again, with Godfather kind of taken, Back to the Future part two always just sticks in my mind as like, I don't think it necessarily holds up the best, and obviously doesn't hold up to the sort of the perfection that is the first film. But in terms of part twos that I'm just exceptionally fond of, that would just be really high up there. And it is a film that I really, like, whenever I think of part two, that's just what I think of. That's the first film I really remember being aware of that was called part two, and it just kind of just that kind of title just felt exciting. And obviously kind of, you know, going all in with the hoverboards and the Nike trainers and things like that, there's those kind of elements that I just always kind of love and remind me of my childhood. So I'm gonna go for Back to the Future part two.
Yeah, just iconic. But just for the record, my true answer is June part two. It's just I've been forbidden from saying it.
Yeah, so that's it from us this week. So thank you for listening, and until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.